This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Rushing and racing and running in circles, moving so fast I'm forgetting my purpose. Blur of the traffic is sending me spinning, getting nowhere. My head and my heart are colliding, chaotic pace of the world, I just wish I could stop it.
Today, more cars are sold in China than in the United States. Chinese companies, many state-owned, are traveling the world to buy up oil to power them. And we are already going to extremes to keep our own fossil fuel economies going, blowing the tops off mountains for coal, the horrible tar sands, and now super deep ocean drilling like BP's Gulf of Mexico blowout. And ours is the fossil economy. Every day, humans burn up fuels made from 5 million years worth of solar power stored by ancient plants. We are burning it all at a rapid rate, loading up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. In fact, all our resources, from metals to rainforest, are being used up, turned into waste, at an incredible rate. Developed economies continue neocolonialism as multinational corporations larger than many countries drag out unobtainium from war-torn, collapsed countries like Sudan and the Congo. Meanwhile, thanks to the glory of television and advertising, humans far from developed countries struggle to join in the final party. If everyone consumed even as much as Europeans, much less North Americans, it would take 3 to 8 planet Earths to do it. Billions want more, and we still want more. A collision of unimaginable proportions is coming.
Try to appear like I've got it together. I'm falling apart. Save me. Somebody take my hand and leave.
Pretty well everyone senses a collapse is inevitable as a natural reality and the laws of physics interrupt our endless party of population and consumption. The only question is, will we drain Earth until it dies? Or will we at least try to plan something else? There is an alternative. It's called degrowth, a planned and willing movement to end the mad economic system of endless growth based on endless consumption and pollution. An admission that really, to survive, humanity needs to shrink our demands upon the planet, to plan out a smaller economy and lower personal ecological footprints. It is time.
The noise of the world is getting me caught up, chasing the clock, and I wish I could stop it. Just need to breathe, somebody please, slow me down.
This is Radio EcoShock. If you go over our past programs, you'll find dozens that lead to degrowth, like Cecil Andrews on the Simplicity Movement, like everything we've ever done on climate change. I suspect most EcoShock listeners, when they investigate degrowth, will feel like they're coming home, finally a name for what we know. On April 30th, 2010, I attended and recorded one evening from a 3-day conference on degrowth. It was historic, the first such gathering in North America.
Consume, consume, consume until we have no planet left to consume. What you need to do is buy things that you don't need. That's the best way to support the economy.
European intellectuals and activists have been leading the development of degrowth. They have a long history and much wider recognition. The first international degrowth conference was held in Paris in April of 2008. There was another, the second conference on economic degrowth for ecological sustainability and social equity, held in Barcelona, Spain in March 2010. Each was remarkable for the wide range of academics and even government officials who attended. The need to limit greed and find alternatives to endless growth is better known in Europe. But a shrinking economy, even though that is obviously in the cards, is still shocking in the heartlands of Buy More, the United States and Canada. So it was a welcome beginning to find 300 people gathering in Vancouver, Canada for the first degrowth meetup on this continent. In this program, you will hear just a few samples from many presentations there, and nothing from the lively discussion circles hashing out the new vision and new rules for living on a limited planet. I'll start with a brief introduction by conference host and author Rex Whaler, a founder of Greenpeace, a member of the Vancouver Peak Oil Executive, and now the Degrowth Movement. We'll also get a short impression of the Barcelona conference from Tom Walker. Then it's time for heavy lifting, the ugly reality of our near-total dependence on fossil fuels that are running out. Even without the tragedy of climate change, peak oil expert Dave Hughes should frighten us all into low-energy life with sustainable power. From many speakers, I've also chosen Jack Alpert from the Stanford Knowledge Integration Laboratory. He'll tell us how many humans could live sustainably on Earth with modern lifestyles. Wait till you hear that number. Be prepared to grow as a human being, but shrink as a burden on the Earth. Let's get going on the biggest project this species has ever known, how to survive our own production.
This is the third degrowth conference in the world. First one that we know about was in Paris, and those of you who heard the French minister speaking last night on the film, very impressive. There are people in political positions in this world who get it, who understand the biophysical reality of what we're dealing with, and who are talking about it. And the first conference was in Paris. There was another one just recently in Barcelona. Tom Walker from Vancouver was in Barcelona at the degrowth conference there. By the way, this movement began to shake sort of economic circles about a decade ago. There was actually an uprising among PhD economic students in Paris, just like Paris 68, Paris 2010, only this was about 10 years ago, so Paris 2000. There was something of an uprising among PhD students, economic students in Paris. They insisted that their economics departments start talking about biophysical economics, ecological economics. And it was quite an upheaval because they couldn't say this was just a bunch of crazy radicals. These were the smartest economic students in France were saying we need to overhaul our universities. Then there was the degrowth conference in Paris. There was a degrowth conference in Barcelona. Tom Walker from Vancouver was in Barcelona. Tom is an educator, a researcher. He's written some important papers regarding the economic fallacies, the lump of labor fallacy, hours of labor fallacy. He's someone who knows how many of these systems work, and he's going to give us a short report from what he heard in Barcelona. Tom Walker.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm a growthaholic. Last month I went to Barcelona to attend this second International Degrowth Conference. There were over 500 people in attendance from 40 countries, 50 papers presented, scientific papers, 80 posters, and there were 28 working groups that met throughout the weekend. Now, being only one person, I was only able to go to one of the poster sessions and one of the paper sessions and two of the working groups, so I can't give you a picture of the entire conference, but you can download the posters and the paper abstracts from the Degrowth website. It's www.degrowth.eu. Get the full picture. What I'm going to do is give you my personal reflections on the conference, really what brought me there in the first place and what I took away, the main thing that I took away from the conference. At any rate, all the important stuff at conferences, it takes place in the corridors and off the conference site. So the big thrill for me was really making contact with Peter Victor, who is going to be teleconferencing into us tomorrow afternoon. So I really highly recommend that people attend tomorrow and hook into that teleconference and see Peter. What brought me to the conference, or what I brought to the conference, was this poster. This poster represents a culmination or a summary, a part of a culmination of about 15 years of research on working time that I've been engaged in. It also summarizes parts of book manuscript that I'm working on, and the title of that working title is The Gift of Prosperity. The basic idea that I'm doing is economists for nearly 200 years have ridiculed and dissed the idea of shorter working time sharing, that it's a fallacy, it's a lump of labor fallacy. And my poster and taking this taunt and turning it into a positive strategy to advance the idea of shorter working time and work sharing. And that's all I'm going to go into because it gets pretty technical. The economics, I was talking to John DeGraff this morning about it, and his eyes glazed over in about 2 or 3 minutes. So I'll move on to what I took away from the conference. And what I took away was, is degrowth politically feasible? Now, even if we can find the technical approaches, the technical solutions to providing a good way of life without economic growth, are the politicians going to buy it? Is the general public going to buy it? How do we move that ahead? And one of the challenges, I think, really comes from the awkwardness of the term degrowth. Now, my experience in Barcelona is that there were, you know, possibly not 500 different interpretations of what people meant by degrowth, but quite a variety of interpretations. Some people thought that meant that the economy shrunk. Some people thought that it meant that we just abandoned the imperative of growth. But rather than try to argue over definitions, what I'm going to do is propose that we add a second term to degrowth to make it a pair of terms, and that's regrowth. So it can be degrowth, regrowth. Because regrowth suggests renewal, it suggests rejuvenation and rebirth, a renaissance, really. So we can think of degrowth as pruning back the tangled overgrowth of high finance and the dead wood of militarism to make room for the tender green shoots of sustainability and social justice. I think the metaphor that I alluded to at the beginning, the 12-step metaphor, is actually quite apt here. In the 12-step programs, the first step is recognizing that growth has made us lose control of our lives. But there are still 11 more steps, and those involve spiritual renewal, spiritual awakening, taking some kind of assessment of the harm we've been doing and making amends for that, and really charting a new path for our lives and following that path. So it's not enough just to go cold turkey on growth. We need to also have a new way forward. And I think that the Sustainable Development Commission actually did have a 12-step program in their report, Prosperity Without Growth. It was called 12 Steps to a Sustainable Society. So I'm going to wrap up now, and I just want to say in closing, growthaholics of the world, relax.
That was Tom Walker giving his impressions of the second International Degrowth Conference in Barcelona, Spain. Now we go to our feature presentation, an overview of the world's fossil energy predicament from Dave Hughes, speaking at the first Degrowth Conference in North America in Vancouver, Canada, and introduced by Rex Whaler.
Ladies and gentlemen, our colleague and friend Dave Hughes has spent decades inside the Canadian Geological Survey of Canada, 32 years. He knows what's going on under the ground all over the world. He's documented the environmental constraints associated with coal and gas resources in Canada. He's on the board of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. He's on the board of the Post Carbon Institute. Again, this is someone who's paid his dues, done his homework, knows what he's talking about, has worked inside the industry, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about our energy future. This lifestyle we're living, this lifestyle where we can waste stuff, I guarantee you, for most of human civilization, people and communities, you don't waste stuff. You'd get booted out of most communities for most of human history if you wasted stuff. People took care of things. They fixed them when they were broken. They saved every resource they could save. We've lived in a very wasteful time, and that's because of this energy bonanza that we found about 150 years ago under the ground. Let me remind you of something. That energy bounty that we found 150 years ago under the ground represents 500 million years of stored solar energy that's retrievable. And each year right now, and Dave and I talked about this on email a few months ago and did the calculation, each year now we are burning 5 million years worth of stored solar energy that's recoverable. So in 1 year, we're taking the energy from 5 million years of solar energy converted to biomass, and we're burning it. That's what's allowing us to bop around and take airplanes and buy trinkets from China and everywhere else. And this is over. And if you ever doubted that it was over, listen to this. Now from Cortez Island in British Columbia, ladies and gentlemen, Dave Hughes.
Thanks very much, Rex. When Rex asked me to speak at a degrowth symposium, I went on the net and looked at the Paris site and some of the things that were there talking about a transition. I've been on the lecture circuit on energy now for just about 10 years. And I'm utterly convinced that degrowth is not an option. We can either intelligently plan a transition to a much lower energy footprint going forward, or Mother Nature will manage that transition for us. And I think it behooves us to listen to a lot of the things that are being said here tonight and then the next few days. Well, in keeping with a Stanley Cup theme, I'd like to talk a bit about hockey sticks, in particular hockey stick graphs with the blade turned upward. We have the disputed hockey stick of global temperature produced by Michael Mann and the indisputable hockey stick graph of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere based on the data from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. There are many other hockey stick graphs that can be produced as a result of the explosion in growth over the past few decades, the increase in global population, the number of motor vehicles, the increase in petroleum-based fertilizers to grow our food, the number of personal computers, the number of cell phones, the number of TV sets, the number of Starbucks outlets, and so forth. There are also hockey sticks with the blade turned downward. These include the number of fish in the oceans, the biodiversity of our ecosystems, the land area covered by old-growth forests. In medicine, it's generally considered advisable to treat the underlying problem, not its symptoms. These hockey sticks are in most ways symptoms of the underlying problem, which is our profligate and unsustainable consumption of fossil fuels. Energy is indeed the mother of all hockey sticks. It's really allowed us to do this damage to our planet. If we look at just the past four decades of consumption of energy, human beings have tripled their rates of consumption. Huge growth in the Asia-Pacific region, lesser growth in Europe and North America. If we look at growth in consumption by fuel, oil is our number one source of fuel, followed by coal and natural gas. But together, fossil fuels make up 86% of our primary energy consumption. The balance, large hydro, nuclear, and all of the other forms of renewables, wind, photovoltaics, geothermal, and so forth. If we look at a little bit further back, this goes back to the end of the last ice age. Human beings made it out of the last ice age with 3 million people. It took us 6,500 years to triple that population to 10 million when we figured out agriculture. Roughly 200 million at the time of Christ, a billion in 1810, 6.8 billion today. Humankind is in a very unique period of its evolutionary existence. And a lot of that explosion in growth is a result of fossilized sunshine. If we look at the last 500 years of that period, we can see that we really got started on coal in about 1700, oil, 1859, natural gas in 1885. And the growth in consumption of energy and population is very highly correlated. Per capita consumption of the human race, the average citizen of the world by fuel, 1850 to 2008. It turns out that the average citizen of the world is using the same amount of renewable energy today as he was in 1850. Problem is that the average citizen is consuming 8 times as much energy as in 1850. People think of coal as a 19th century fuel, but in fact, the average citizen of the world consumes the same amount of fuel today as in 1910. Oil really allowed us to increase our total per capita consumption. It didn't really displace coal at all. Natural gas increased it further still. Uranium further still. The problem is 89% of our per capita consumption is non-renewable. Oil, gas, coal, and uranium. And so this is what I term the energy sustainability dilemma. There's 5.3 times as many people as in 1850. Each person is consuming 8.6 times as much energy on a per capita basis. The world is consuming 46 times as much energy as in 1850. 89% of that is non-renewable. Most of those fuels will have a peak in production in the first half of this century. If you remember 3 words from this lecture, remember these three. Beware of scale. The 86% of our primary energy we get from fossil fuels is a lot of energy. Less than 1% of primary energy consumption is now provided by non-hydropower renewables. There are no scalable alternatives to hydrocarbons at the rates of energy throughput we enjoy at this point in time. Unconventional hydrocarbon production is difficult to scale compared to the cheap hydrocarbons of yesteryear. Tar sands, extra heavy oil, biofuels simply cannot be scaled fast enough to come anywhere near close to replacing the throughput of cheap liquids we enjoy today. If we look at consumption of oil by the human race, first oil well, 1859. As of year-end 2008, we consumed 1.1 trillion barrels of oil. That's somewhere between half and a third of all the oil that will ever be consumed. What gets me about this chart is 90% of this oil has been consumed since 1960, half of it since 1986, and 10% since 2005. So we're on a vicious uphill spiral of consumption of oil. If we look at production and consumption of oil by geopolitics, the non-OPEC world outside of the former Soviet Union produced 39% of the world's oil in 2008, but consumed 84% of it. Non-OPEC production peaked in 2002. All non-OPEC production, including the former Soviet Union, peaked in 2007. OPEC produced 45% of the world's oil and consumed only 11%. But OPEC countries are consuming far more of their oil internally with less oil to export. Discoveries of oil globally, the green bars are the amount of oil discovered each year. The black line is the amount of oil consumed. World oil discoveries peaked in about 1965, and since 1983, we've consumed more oil than we've discovered in each year. So we're really eating into the oil bank account of previous discoveries, consuming 3 to 4 barrels of oil for every barrel that we're finding. Peak oil, more and more talk about when world oil production will peak. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Difficult to predict exactly when because of the variables, but it depends on how much is there, how much is recoverable at a net energy profit, and how fast we consume it, a function of price, infrastructure, and so forth. Many forecasts of when world oil production will peak. Colin Campbell published a watershed study in New Scientist back in the late 90s about peak oil. Colin Campbell is certain that world oil production peaked in 2008. There's been many other published estimates. The real optimists on peak oil are located in Washington. The statistical arm of the U.S. Department of Energy, the Energy Information Administration, suggesting world oil production may not peak until 2044. The median of these estimates is 2015, and if you take out the two high ones, it's 2012, which is tomorrow in terms of planning to mitigate the effects of peak oil. You can go on the EIA's website and download their reference case forecast. Basically, smooth growth in production of oil through 2030 at least. I'd just like to point out unconventional oil, things like tar sands, biofuels. Even if we quadruple unconventional oil, it can't offset the declines in cheap liquids after peak oil. Many geologists would suggest we'll never get past about 95 million barrels a day. We're at 86 right now. And that will occur in the right about now, or maybe as late as 2014. This is what world oil production looks like over the last decade. The world has, in fact, been on a production plateau since early 2005. We had a peak to date in 2008. Non-OPEC, as I mentioned, peaked in 2007. The only question is, will more investment allow us to resume the growth in oil production? We spend a few trillion dollars on upstream oil and gas exploration. The story of oil production in Canada is a story about tar sands. The reference case calls for a tripling of tar sands production by 2020 in this case. If we actually could do that, Canada would be about 4% of forecast world oil demand. The concept of net energy, energy return on investment, is extremely important with fossil fuels. In the good old days in Saudi Arabia, the net energy payback from drilling an oil well and producing that oil was about 100 to 1. Today, 25 to 1. Tar sands, mineable tar sands, about 6 to 1. In situ tar sands, 3 to 1. Things like ethanol from corn, somewhere between 25% energy negative to 25% energy positive, a very poor source of liquid fuels. If we look at natural gas, we got started a bit later with gas than we did with oil. We've consumed about half a trillion barrels of oil equivalent of natural gas as of 2008. Again, very striking. 90% of all the natural gas burned to date has been burned since 1965, half of it since 1991, and 10% of it since 2006. So we're on the same uphill spiral of consumption with gas as we are with oil. Production of and consumption of natural gas has more than tripled since 1970 in the world. North America produced and consumed about 30% of the world's gas in 2008. Peak gas likely to be further out than peak oil. This is a projection by Colin Campbell suggesting a global peak in gas in about 2045. If we look at Canadian gas production, we're on what I call an exploration treadmill. In 1996, we drilled 4,000 successful gas wells. We quadrupled that to nearly 16,000 wells in 2005. We grew production by about 10% until we hit a plateau, and now production in Canada is in quite a steep decline. We only found enough gas to replace production in about three of the last 12 years. This is what Canadian gas production looks like now. This contains data up until December 2009. It's now falling at about 8.2% per year. Yet people like Apache are talking about building a pipeline to Kitimat and building an LNG liquefaction facility to export Canadian gas. I scratch my head when I hear this. The story about gas is that the declines are much quicker with gas than they are for oil. And this is production of Canadian gas by the year the well was drilled. And it turns out that 60% of Canadian production comes from wells drilled in the last 6 years. So if you have to keep drilling to keep production flat, the NEB's forecast of Canadian gas production through 2012, they're suggesting a 17% decline. I suggest that's probably optimistic. Going forward, the NEB is generally pretty optimistic. They're suggesting a radical turnaround just beyond their short-term forecast. I'll believe that when I see it. If you look at the U.S., the story about overall declines in the U.S. is even worse than Canada. 60% of their production comes from wells drilled in the last 4 years. Their overall decline per year is about a third. So a third of production has to be replaced by more drilling each year. Nonetheless, the EIA is very optimistic about gas production in the U.S. People like T. Boone Pickens are talking about replacing the fleet with natural gas-powered vehicles. There's a lot of hype about shale gas, a quintupling in this forecast, and an overall growth in production from the lower 48 of about 22% by 2035. How realistic is that? Not very. It turns out that the U.S. is on the same exploration treadmill that Canada's on. They almost quadrupled the number of wells from 10,000 in the late 90s to 36,000 in 2008, just about the time Lehman Brothers collapsed. So they drilled 200% more wells. They grew production by about 15%. The story about shale gas, which is hailed really as the great new source of gas in the U.S., is a story about very high decline rates. The first year decline rate of a typical shale gas well is 65%. Some of them are as high as 85%. So again, more drilling to keep production flat. This is what I would see as a reasonable scenario for U.S. gas supply going forward. If they can hold their declines to about 1.8% per year, they'll be short 40% of their forecast demand by 2035 going forward. The story of natural gas is also a story about net energy. As we go down the food chain to lower quality sources of gas, we need to invest more and more energy getting the gas compared to the energy we get back. Coal bed methane wells, for example, are a lot of very low productivity wells, so we need to drill a lot more of them.
This is Radio EcoShock from the April 2010 Degrowth Conference in Vancouver, Canada. You are listening to Dave Hughes explain the energy options for Canada and the United States.
Coal, cumulative consumption of coal by the human race. We've consumed more energy in terms of coal than we have in terms of oil and gas. 90% of all the coal ever consumed has been burned since 1910, half since 1973, 10% since 2003. Coal is now the fastest growing fossil fuel source in the world. Production and consumption of coal in the world. The story of growth in both production and consumption is the Asia Pacific, China, India, Australia. If we look around the world at where the remaining hydrocarbon energy is, it turns out about 60% of what's left of the world's hydrocarbons are contained in coal. Peak coal. Coal once was considered a fuel for thousands of years. There's been several very good studies done in the last 2 or 3 years suggesting a global peak in coal production by as early as 2025 and a peak in China in about 2020. This is one of them by Energy Watch Group out of Germany. Another one, a very credible study out of Caltech by a fellow by the name of Dave Rutledge, suggesting peak coal in 2021 and a global peak of all hydrocarbons in 2020. Rutledge looked at basically a scenario of liquidating all the hydrocarbons that can be produced at a net energy profit as fast as we can produce them. And he concluded that we can't get carbon levels in the atmosphere up to even the lowest IPCC scenario. Not to say that carbon is not a very important issue going forward. It's also to say we have this depletion issue that we have to deal with. If we look at Rutledge's forecast of remaining hydrocarbons yet to be produced, when I was born back in 1950, 95% of the ultimate recoverable hydrocarbons had yet to be produced. Today, we produced about 42%. If we keep burning them as fast as we can produce them, 80% will be gone by 2050, 98% gone by 2100. And considering how incredibly useful hydrocarbons are as a dense form of energy, that's an incredible problem for future generations. I'd like to point out that we're going to need hydrocarbons to build the infrastructure that comes next. A 2-megawatt windmill, for example, has 260 tons of steel in it, which requires 300 tons of iron ore and 170 tons of coking coal to make, all mined and transported with hydrocarbons. Rutledge looked at CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. If we burn all remaining hydrocarbons as fast as they can be produced, and he suggested we could just get to Hansen's earlier danger threshold of about 450 ppm in the atmosphere. Rutledge suggested a peak temperature in his scenario of burning all the hydrocarbons as fast as we can produce them in about 2064 at about 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. If we look at forecast of world electricity generation, coal is forecast to be the major fuel source for electricity going forward to 2030 at least, followed by natural gas. Nuclear grows in real terms but loses market share. large hydro grows in real terms but loses market share. On renewables, this is geothermal, wind, photovoltaic. If we can grow those by quadruple, renewables could be 6% of forecast consumption. And that's what I mean when I say beware of scale. Renewables have to grow a lot, but they're difficult to scale compared to the throughput we get from fossil fuels. U.S. electricity generation by fuel, coal, 44% in 2035 in this forecast. And renewables, if we can somehow grow U.S. renewables by a factor of 5, renewables could be 11% of U.S. generation. And this is what that renewable forecast looks like. It turns out that wind grows by more than 6-fold, but the most important source of renewables is wood and other biomass, growing by 7 times. Photovoltaics, if we grow photovoltaics by 30 times, they'll still be less than 0.5% of forecast consumption. There's been a huge amount of wind generation capacity built in the U.S. over the last decade. This is the installed wind generation. And if we look at the properties of wind, wind is not a very favorable source of electricity because it's intermittent and it's unpredictable. And this is the amount of electricity you actually generated from wind over the last couple of years compared to the installed capacity. It's about 31% because of intermittency and unpredictability. What about nuclear globally? It turns out that the 430 nuclear plants in the world are all getting old. Many of them were built back in the 70s and 80s with a 40-year lifespan. So those plants either have to be repowered or decommissioned and replaced with new plants. And this is a trajectory of nuclear in the world. If we only commission 2 or 3 nuclear plants per year, to keep nuclear capacity flat, we need to be building somewhere around 10 to 12 nuclear plants each year, and we're not doing that. Hydrogen, the so-called hydrogen economy, is it the silver bullet? Well, in fact, hydrogen is an energy carrier. It's not an energy source. Most hydrogen in the world is made from steam reforming natural gas. And if we do that, we lose 30% of the energy in the gas. We can make it with electricity, but again, we lose 30% of the energy in the electricity. Because of these energy losses in conversion from other forms of energy to hydrogen, it's likely not going to be more than a niche fuel going forward. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences has published some very good papers on the hydrogen economy, looking at things like storage, distribution, fuel cell cost, and longevity. And there's a huge amount of problems. There's no such thing as a free lunch when it comes to energy. A comparison with hydrogen and other ways of carrying energy. This is energy density by volume and by weight. And it turns out that batteries are the worst way to carry energy, followed by compressed hydrogen gas. Liquid hydrogen is better, but we have to keep it at minus 253 degrees centigrade, which is problematic. But nothing can compare to the energy density, convenience, storage ease, and so forth of gasoline, diesel fuel, and propane. The last piece of the sustainability puzzle, the whole issue of population growth and aspirations of growth and consumption, particularly in the developing world. We've heard already tonight there's a great inequity in terms of per capita consumption of energy in the world. Canada is at the top of the food chain. Canadians consume 6 times the world average, 7 times China, 29 times India. The problem is 3/4 of the world's population are below the world average of energy consumption. And these people aspire to consumption levels of the first world. Oil into China, for example, China was a net exporter of oil up until 1993. 2008, it imported over 1/2 of its oil. India now imports 3/4 of its oil. The rest of developing Asia, more than 1/2 of its oil, in competition with the U.S., Japan, and everybody else that wants imported oil. If we look at per capita consumption in the world, we can see how Canada, for example, compares to Europe. Canadians consume 3 times as much energy as the average European, and vastly more energy than countries like India or China. CO2 emissions, Canada and the U.S. consume about 20 tons per capita, more than four times the world average, about four times that of China. I wasn't too surprised about Copenhagen, considering how vastly above all of those developing countries we are in terms of our per capita consumption. World population forecast to hit 9.2 billion people, U.S. Bureau Census, in 2050. If we plot motor vehicles on that same vertical axis, there's 850 million motor vehicles in the world, 240 million in the U.S., 50 million in China. China is now the world's biggest market for motor vehicles. 70 million new motor vehicles built in 2008, about the same number of net people added to the planet. Food. Hydrocarbons are used in production of food. Things like feedlot beef. This is a net energy for different ways of getting food. Feedlot beef, very inefficient. Coastal fishing, much more efficient. Range-fed beef, very efficient. The U.S. food system has gone from 1-to-1 to 10-to-1 in the 70s, and that's about where it is now. Diesel fuel, nitrogen from natural gas, pesticides, and so forth. Returning to the dilemma, 5.3 times as many people as in 1850, each person consuming 8.6 times as much energy, 46 times the consumption of 1850. If you believe the reference case forecast out of the EIA in Washington, this is what the world would look like in 2030 if that was possible. 6.6 times as many people as in 1850. Each person consuming 9.5 times as much energy. A world that consumes 63 times as much energy as in 1850. 89% non-renewable. Anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. The term sustainable growth is an oxymoron. Just to wind up, the energy sustainability dilemma in my mind will be the defining issue of our time, as the economic growth paradigm abuts physical limits to growth. Although Canada is likely to be able to meet its domestic energy requirements from internal sources through 2030, it will not be exempt from economic fallout of global energy resource limitations. The climate change dialogue, for the most part, excludes consideration of resource limitations on growth. I'm talking about big climate in big governments, not particularly this group. And hence leads us down some counterproductive pathways, although initiatives on conservation efficiency and renewables fortuitously also address the energy question. Hydrocarbons represent an extremely convenient, dense form of non-renewable energy for which there are no scalable alternatives. They will be needed for the development of infrastructure for the next paradigm of more sustainable human development. A sustainable energy future is not out of reach, but will be hugely challenging. Several Manhattan projects. We best get on with it. Thank you very much.
You just heard Dave Hughes, a Canadian energy researcher, given what is now known across North America as the talk. As he makes numerous presentations with his graphs and helpful facts, Dave's kind of an energy Al Gore, don't you think? This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're listening to recordings from North America's first degrowth conference held in Vancouver, Canada from April 29th to May 2nd. One of the principal organizers was Conrad Schmidt, head of the Work Less Party, and job sharing is one of the tools available to keep people going as we share sustainable life. Here is a short clip from York University professor and no-growth advocate, Peter Victor.
In my work, I try to see whether we could run our economy in a very different way so that we could still live good lives, we could have high levels of employment, we could reduce poverty, we can reduce the pressures on the environment, and all without relying on economic growth. And the work I've done, where I use a lot of numbers and computers and things of that sort, suggests that yes, it can be quite feasible for us to live very good lives, particularly those of us already living in wealthy northern countries, without having to rely on ever-expanding economies. At this conference, which is concerned with degrowth, the question that I've been looking at is a little tougher, and that is that it's not just a question of stabilizing our economy, but possibly shrinking the economy. Could we have good lives if the economy was smaller than it is today? And that's tougher to do than simply stabilizing the economy where we are, but it is possible. It would require more dramatic changes, in particular, as one example, shorter work hours. One of the ways that we can ensure high levels of employment, even if we're not expanding the economy, is if we share the amount of work among more people. And as a very recent example of this, in the recession in Canada where I live, the unions in the car industry, rather than let their co-workers be fired, all agreed to work less so that everybody would stay in the job. Well, that was a short-term solution to what was seen as a short-term problem. I think that's actually the seeds of a long-term solution to our problems, and it's just the sort of thing that we have to do. Well, one question then is, what do we mean when we say that people can live a good life even if the economy is not growing? To answer that question, you have to think about what's really important in life. Of course, we all want to be well-fed and well-housed and clothed and have the ability to move around. But we also know that we want time to spend with our families, time to spend with our children, time with our friends, time doing sport, time doing things which are not particularly burdensome on the environment. So one of the things we have to do is to remove the obstacles, which could be in the tax system, they could be in the system of employment, that are preventing people from working the number of hours that they in fact truly wish to work to have a better life.
Find that clip of Peter Victor on YouTube. We only have time for one more speech from Vancouver's Degrowth Conference. Remember, the idea is we're headed for a collapse due to overuse of the planet's resources, plus a sudden demand for equality of life from billions more people in the world. Should we wait for war and famine? Or can we still plan not just to limit our consumption, but to reduce it drastically? Collapse or degrowth seem to be the only options left. Let's say we want to keep high-tech solutions like hospitals and reasonable use of rapid transportation like high-speed trains, and we want everyone on the planet to have enough to eat without using up the soil or poisoning the planet with pollution. How many humans can Earth really support in this way for thousands of generations? Jack Elpert has figured that out. The reality is shocking. Here is Greenpeace founder Rex Whaler introducing Jack.
Graphs are a way of talking about change over time. So when we're talking about stabilizing and reducing human population, we're not talking about going out on the streets and killing people. We're talking about things such as women's rights, contraception available, global education to help families reduce their numbers and help communities stabilize themselves. Now, one person that has done a lot of work in this and has also done some work in looking at what he calls time blindness, our inability to see how these changes magnify over time, is Jack Alpert. Jack worked with General Motors, did a lot of work on trying to communicate to people to use safety belts. He found out how difficult that was, and he has since gotten into studying how people process important information. Those of you who are parents know how many times you have to tell your children something? Many times. And how do people actually process this important information that we're hearing tonight, and how do they start inculcating these ideas into the way they live their lives? Jack also did some work at Cisco Systems as a training manager. He now works with the Stanford Knowledge Integration Laboratory called SKILL, and he wants to talk to you a little bit tonight about what he thinks is a sustainable human population level. Now, remember, we're not talking about going out and killing anyone. We're talking about finding ways that we can reduce our population over a period of time so that in 100 years we're not on a planet that's going nuts with 15 billion people, half of them starving to death. We're on a planet with a lot less people living good, rich, happy lives. Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Alpert.
This is a great group. It's a great conference, and I'm really glad to be here. This thing about seatbelts, I put them in cars in 1968, and people wouldn't wear them. and made me feel pretty bad because we made the probability of dying in your car go from 1 in 200 to 1 in 26,000. So it was a no-brainer. Put your seatbelt on, you wouldn't die in a car accident. Well, the thing that really got me out of engineering was the fact that polio vaccines did exactly the same thing. So polio vaccines did the same thing. And the difference was that the same mother that would get her kids vaccinated wouldn't put on her seatbelt. And I quit engineering and I started to study how people gather, process, and evaluate information. And what I learned is they can't connect the dots. Okay, so I wrote an interactive computer exam for sixth graders. And it was a little problem where how things played out was the important way to figure out how to make the decisions in the first year. So you made decisions over the consecutive years. Anyway, they didn't do very well. And since I was at Stanford, I gave it to a bunch of Stanford students. Now you got to believe that the Stanford students are brighter than the average Palo Alto sixth grader, but they didn't do very well either. So then I gave it to a bunch of Stanford faculty. And you can imagine that they didn't love me because the results were, and this was prototyping. We're all prototype. And because it's Stanford, I gathered together all the Nobel laureates and all the Wolf Prize winners. And from the scores at this preliminary evaluation, the Nobel laureates and the sixth graders are about the same in looking at the future, okay, and looking at the present, taking the structure, pushing it out forward and saying, oh, I don't want to go there. So we're all about the same. Okay, so that's what I did for 40 years. And it takes a little time to explain it. It's called how we deal with nonlinearity. So I'm not going to do that tonight. I just wanted you to know that we're all kind of crippled. What you heard from, let's see, David, Anita, Rick, and Bill was, it's kind of black out there. Our future doesn't look very good. But I didn't see anybody run for the exits because they wanted to change their lives. So what I want to do tonight is show you a little video that says, when I run the numbers for how many people could live in the world and have it be sustainable and peaceful, it looks like this. And I'm going to try and make you think about how many people can actually live in the world.
Species extinction is caused by too many people. Depleted fisheries caused by too many people. Starvation, too many people. In fact, overpopulation causes genocide, migration, and probably climate change. What number is not too many? My estimate, below 100 million. How did I arrive at this number? We know that rich people consume a lot. Poor people consume very little. Most of us fall somewhere in between. All of us together create a burden of, let's say, 20 footprint units. The richest 20% create 16 of these. The remaining 5.1 billion create only 4 units. I'm sure you know the world's population is greater than 6.4 billion. Using this number eliminates a need for a calculator, and the conclusions will be the same. The average home of the richest 20% looks like this. The poorest 80%, more like this. This injustice creates social conflict. However, expectations that the 5 billion poor people will achieve the average rich well-being keeps the social conflict from exploding in our faces. What if they succeed? Then the human footprint increases from 20 to 80. 20 footprint units is already enough to exhaust and degrade Earth. 80 would do it 4 times faster. If a more equal distribution of the Earth's bounty is necessary to limit conflict, it must be facilitated without increasing this total human footprint. Either each person in the rich group must reassign 75% of his or her consumption to the poor, or global population must contract to a quarter its present size. To attain a more peaceful world requires lowering the population to 1.6 billion. However, even if we could attain a global population of 1.6 billion people, the sum of all these numbers, and, for example, Canada had 8 million instead of 32, England had 15 instead of 60, and China had 320 million instead of 1.3 billion, and all of these other regions had one quarter of their populations, Notice the United States had 87 million rather than 350. And each of these countries enjoyed an average North American lifestyle. This new world would not be eco-sustainable. We would still be consuming our fossil fuel and water to extinction. We would still be reducing production of renewables like fisheries. And we would still be reducing the natural recycling and absorption capacities of our ecosystem. The world's sustainable population would be smaller. How much smaller? There are many ways to calculate the world's sustainable population. Take any non-renewable supporting resource, for example, oil, and ask how long it would last for different populations. Our oil would last 500 years if we had 100 million. Take any non-exhaustible resource, for example, hydropower, and ask how many people will it support if other energy resources, for example, fossil fuels, are not used. The answer is near 100 million. Take any renewing resource and ask how many people it can support if the usage rate does not degrade its supply. Let me provide calculations using soil as an example. Most farming activities lower both soil quality and quantity. Plowing and runoff erode soil. Crops mine the soil's minerals. Therefore, soil is lost in the farming process. All would be gone if it were not for the natural processes that generate new soil. Sustainable farming practice means the amount of soil lost equals the amount created. However, on average, today's farming techniques lose soil 16 times faster than Mother Nature makes it. That is, it would take 15 years to replace what was lost in a year of farming. On average, to be sustainable, after an acre is farmed, it would have to remain fallow for 15 years. This means we can farm only 1/16 of our land. We can feed only 1/16 of the 1.6 billion people. The peaceful population living at North American lifestyles with sustainable soil practices is 100 million people. Wait a minute. We're not finished. Even a reduction to 100 million is not sustainable. Humans strive for better well-being. For example, people prefer to live longer. An 86-year lifespan is better than an 85-year lifespan. However, an individual who lives 1 year longer increases his lifetime footprint by a little over 1%. Just to accommodate this 1 year increase in lifespan, the population of 100 million would have to decrease to 99 million. There are thousands of lifestyle improvements that would require similar decreases in population. As long as people yearn for eco-sustainability, peace through social justice, and ever-increasing well-being, the global population will have to continue to decrease below 100 million.
Thank you. I didn't do this to rain on this party. It just means that the how far we have to go to get rid of the problems that we have today is a very long way from where we are now. And we should look consciously at what we're proposing and see if it gets us anywhere near what we're wishing for. Thank you.
That short talk barely touches the depths of Jack Alpert's experience and thinking about humanity. For example, he's developed a theory that explains our inability to deal with long-term problems like limited energy or climate change. He calls it time blindness. Jack has agreed to do a future interview with Radio EcoShock, but in the meantime, you can watch a full-length video at the website skill.org. That's skil.org with just one L. And we've hardly covered the many presentations and discussions from the three-day conference in Vancouver at the end of April 2010. You can find a couple more speeches on the Economic Crisis page in our audio on-demand menu at ecoshock.org. Conference organizers are also offering a DVD of the entire proceedings with screening rights. Find the details at www.degrowth.com. And that website is d-growth.com. My thanks for permission to record and broadcast what you have heard today. For a quick introduction to this movement and its intellectual roots, look up degrowth, all one word, at Wikipedia. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I invite you to cruise our archive of past programs at ecoshock.org for a lot more ideas about simple living, real sustainable energy tech, and ways to live in a just and lasting world. Thank you for listening.
Chasing the clock, and I wish I could stop it. Just need to breathe. Somebody please.